and welcome to the YuppieCast. My apologies to Nate Mavis. I was about 5 minutes late because it was very crowded at the Whole Foods, but I now have all the ingredients that I'll need to make a delicious goat cheese and walnut salad. And I have got my coffee freshly brewed in a French press, and I am ready to go. How are we doing today, Nate?
I'm doing great. I have my orange tea in a nice, reasonable, not too expensive mug here, and I'm ready to go.
And you finished your graduate work at a New England university for the day?
Yeah, I'm only two-thirds through my dissertation work for the day.
Okay, so you're pausing in your academic studies to record a podcast. Still, yeah. a plenty yuppie thing to do.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so this is, of course, actually the Thinking Poker podcast. I'm Andrew Brokus here with Nate Mavis. And our guest today, we are very excited to have Vanessa Selbst on the show. Yeah. So this is a pretty big get for us. Nice job, Nate.
She's won enough money from me in my life that I think she thinks she owes me one.
So a great conversation with Vanessa coming up. Yeah. Let's start off with the answers on last week's mailbag. We had a question from Sean about how to teach, I guess, Nate was calling it meta-rationality, how to teach the idea, I guess, getting comfortable with failure, getting comfortable with making mistakes to people who you're supposed to be managing at work, and in particular, maybe people who don't have any experience failing in that way, the kind of experience that many poker players do have just through having put in many hours at the table. Of course, you're going to have a lot of times where you make mistakes, or even without making a mistake, something goes wrong. And I think a lot of poker players end up learning that that's okay. It's not the end of the world. And it's one of the many good things you can learn from being a serious poker player. And Sean was wondering whether there was whether we had any suggestions for ways of teaching this to people that you manage at work.
Yeah. And for any new listeners, this gets all the way back to episode 3 with our interview with Jason Strasser. And he mentioned a few times that in his line of work, which is finance, he's on Wall Street, you got a lot of people. And he referred a couple times to a Harvard 4.0 guy who is brilliant, knows a lot, has a lot of first order knowledge, but sometimes is less good at reacting to failure, is less good at critically evaluating thought processes, is less good at having the right kind of critical perspective on their own thought. And he said this is something that poker players, despite their sometimes weaker credentials, do really well. They're very self-critical. They're very aware of ways in which they might go wrong. And they're, in a sense, more experienced with managing themselves the way you might manage somebody else.
So I think Sean asked a pretty good question about how you could teach those kind of skills to a non-poker player, or get someone from what Jason was calling, I was going to leave the Harvard bashing out of it, what Jason was calling the Harvard 4.0 career path sort of person, and teach them some of the skills that the poker career path person might have. Unfortunately, Nate and I didn't really have a lot of great suggestions, having never been managers ourselves. So we threw the question up to our audience, and we did, in fact, get a response from somebody who sounded pretty qualified to respond. So we had Jason write in to say that he's a scientist in the pharmaceutical industry. So even though he doesn't work in finance, he's had quite a bit of management experience over his 15-year career. And he suggests that by giving your reports freedom to make decisions, they will inevitably make mistakes. That is where good managers will offer support and let them know that it is okay to make mistakes and fail. If the reports see that it won't be the end of the world, they will take more chances. In science, it might not be a $1 billion gaffe, but it will have cost time and some money.
That sounds very sensible to me. One thing we were talking about is I don't have the management experience that Jason has, but I have spent time tutoring calculus and teaching philosophy at universities, right? And asking people to predict likely causes of failure can be really useful. So Tyler Cowen, the blogger, one of his sort of favorite interview questions when he's interviewing somebody is, what do you consider the best argument against your own position? And some people are really not good at answering that question. And you might also ask somebody who comes to you with a project, like, what's the most likely way in which this project will fail? And a lot of people just are not accustomed to thinking like that. They're used to defending their positions. They're used to finding reasons why the things they believe to be true are true and things like that. So asking people to predict their own failure, even if they think it's not very likely, predicting the most likely cause of their own failure and the best arguments against their own position and things like this, first of all, it's just very healthy as a matter of being a responsible consumer of information. But it's also a good way to force somebody into that kind of third-person distance to themselves, where they start seeing themselves as an agent that sometimes goes wrong, then they start thinking about some of the consistent ways in which they go wrong.
That's actually a skill that I learned not so much from poker as from my time in competitive debate, which some people listening might know. I was a nationally competitive debater in high school and in college, and I've also taught academic debate, like a debate kind of as an extracurricular activity, the same way that a school might have a football team or a baseball team. I was involved in starting debate teams at a number of high schools in the Boston public school system. And so I've taught debate to a lot of people, and I was a pretty serious debater myself when I was a student. And then obviously that's a big thing when you're arguing competitively and you're trying to succeed at it very well. One of the big things you're going to have to do is, once you know what position you're going to be trying to defend, you have to anticipate what are the likely attacks against it. And there are, I guess, a few different points at which you have to evaluate that question of what's the best argument against what I'm going to be defending. So first is when you have a choice of defending several different things, and you're just taking a first level strategy of like, okay, what position do I want to take? And when you're thinking at it in debate as a competitive activity, you're not necessarily defending a position that is actually your belief. You're thinking about it more in terms of strategy and saying like, what's the most defensible position? What argument will have the best chance of winning this debate for me? So you're often thinking in a very utilitarian way, like, okay, what's the biggest weakness of this argument? What's the biggest weakness of that argument? And every argument's going to have a weakness. So it's not about trying to find an argument that's flawless. It's just about trying to find the one that you think is most defensible against its biggest weaknesses. And then, yeah, secondly, once you're actually involved in a debate with other trained competitors, then you've got to be constantly assessing that question of, within the context of this argument we're having right now, of the arguments that they've made, which is the biggest threat to me and to my position, and making sure that in the limited time that you have to speak, you're allocating your time accordingly. You're addressing everything that they've said, but you're giving appropriate weight to the most threatening arguments that they've made. So more so than poker, that was really where I learned, although it's a skill that's been very useful to me in poker. It's essentially the same thing that you're thinking when you say, how can I be exploited? If I'm going to value bet this hand here, how can my opponent exploit that? Or if I'm going to make this sort of fold, how could my opponent take advantage of that? It's more or less the same question.
I mean, some of these things that Jason was talking about, and I have a particular interest in it, is where you go beyond like some specific argument or some specific strategy and start thinking about yourself as an agent. It's not just, well, if I raise here, then I lose deception, but what I gain is worth it. Where you start to evaluate yourself roughly the same way you would evaluate somebody you met on the street or a friend that you know really well, you know, where you just sort of take account of the fact that you have weaknesses and deficiencies. Thanks to Jason for writing in and, from a position of actual experience and expertise at managing people. We appreciate that.
Yeah, good comment, good answer.
Yeah. So time for our strategy segment. Recently, Andrew wrote a piece called Winning in a Tight Game. It's up on Card Player if you want to read it. And we thought that on the podcast, we would examine sort of the converse question about winning in loose games, because I play in a lot of loose games, at least when I play. A lot of you play in loose games, judging from the email we get, and they require different skills.
Agreed.
So I have some psychological things to say, and I have some strategic things to say. Which one do you want to start with?
Let's start with psychology.
Yeah, so one obvious bit of psychology is that you often want to be in a loose game, but loose games often move slower because it takes longer for more people to act, especially live. So you can be sitting there getting, 20 hands an hour, 15 hands an hour. And especially if you're stuck, and especially if you think that some of these loose players are going to lose all their money before you get any of it, it's really psychologically demanding in some of the same ways that playing a big tournament can be demanding, just that it moves slower than you're used to. And so, I mean, this is something where I think preparation really does help. And when you sit in a loose game, you can just say to yourself, I'm going to get hands slowly. I might lose a bigger fraction of the pots I invest money in just because more players are contesting it. So there's a good chance I'm going to be stuck. So there's a pretty good chance that I'm going to be stuck and sitting around and waiting and getting 15 hands an hour. And that will be annoying, but I will deal with it.
Yeah, that's actually a good throwback to what we were just talking about, anticipating what could go wrong. I think rather than just sitting down at the poker table and waiting for cards to be dealt to you and kind of playing everything in a vacuum, anticipating ahead of time, saying to yourself, even if it's not before you sit down, like maybe you don't know that the game is loose before you sit down, but as you start to realize it, explicitly saying, okay, here's the way the table is playing, here's the mistakes I'm seeing people make, here's the strategy I'm going to adopt to take advantage of those, and here's what that's going to mean for me in a concrete way. So not just saying, oh, these guys are really loose passive, I hope I get some big hands, but really thinking about the things Nate was just saying. What does that mean I'm going to have to do when I don't have big hands, right? What kind of mistake am I likely to make? It's not that hard to win money from loose players when you get a big hand. So maybe the thing you need to focus most on is not how am I going to win a lot of money when I have a big hand, but how am I going to avoid getting bored and splashing around, trying to steal blinds from under the gun when it's obviously not going to work, or whatever. What kind of mistakes am I likely to make?
Yeah, a dear friend of mine once showed a remarkable amount of self-knowledge by actually going to a bookstore, buying a novel he wanted to read, and then taking it to a stud game he was playing in, just because he knew he would get annoyed and start playing too many hands if he didn't have a really good book to read. So that's so slightly less attentive than you might want, but certainly better than any of the alternatives available to him that day,
I do bring a
psychologically.
book to the World Series of Poker Bubble Day, the main event. The one year I was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X, and I think I got a couple of chapters in during the bubble. That was back when they played a longer bubble, or a longer hand for hand period of time. But yeah, I think that's not a bad idea, especially when you're literally not playing, you're just waiting for other tables to finish.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, I usually make a big thing out of sort of spending every moment I can focusing as hard as I can on my opponents. But yeah, during the bubble, there's just so much sitting around. I mean, once this definitely backfired on me. At the other time, I had the good luck to be sitting right next to Russ Rosenblum, who is awesome. And
Yeah, he's fun to talk to. I've played with him as well.
yeah, so plan ahead if you need to. You give something up if you listen to music, but you could listen to a very informative poker podcast maybe while you're waiting for a good hand at a tight game. And
Any suggestions?
I can think of
Do you know any informative ones?
one. So that's Tournamentality by Vanessa Selbst is very good.
Oh, that is good. Yeah, seriously, I don't think there's anything. Like most of these days, when I read like a poker book or something, and this isn't as true for poker videos, but like when I read a poker book, I'm not usually reading it to gain new information as much as like to write a review for my blog or something. And I don't really read like 2+2 strategy forums that much anymore. I mostly just read NVG to get like gossip and drama bombs and things like that. So I really like Vanessa Selbst's Tournamentality has been the one thing that I feel like in recent years. That I like an external tool that I've learned a lot from, like not just thinking about poker myself or talking about poker with other good poker players, but when I've sat down and like read a book or listened to a podcast or even watched a video, I think Tournamentality is like the one I've had the most kind of aha moments, or just like, oh wow, I really feel like I'm getting better at poker just listening to this.
There are only 12 episodes. The production value is not very good. And in my more selfish moments, I'm actually happy that the production value is not very good because I think it turns people away from it. And it's just solid gold. The information is solid gold. It's about a few years old by now, but it's holding up very well. And yeah, you really want to listen to Tournamentality. So we have psychological preparations, and we've talked about what you should do between playable hands, but of course, there are differences in what you do with your playable hands when you are at a loose table. I think one mistake I see people make a lot, and one mistake I've made a lot in my own life, is shutting some of the loosest players out of the pot. Like, it can be a very big mistake to, say, raise with a nut flush draw in a big multi-way pot when there are a lot of people who will stick around with overcards, with bottom pair, with a hand like that.
With worse flush draws.
Yeah, oh yeah, worse flush draws. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, there are also reasons to raise and bloat the pot and then try to win a huge pot. It depends on stack depth, it depends on many things, and we assume that you already know how to evaluate some of those factors. But I think I see people making the mistake of raising when they should call and shutting some of their worst opponents out of the pot and loosest opponents out of the pot. I see that mistake made more often and in a more costly way than the mistake of calling when they should raise.
That's interesting.
Do you think you see that?
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I wouldn't have, it didn't immediately occur to me, but yeah, I think that's probably right.
Yeah, I mean, I can think of a few vivid examples of that now. One was just, you know, a very loose player in the blind, and it was three-handed to the flop and pretty ragged with a flush draw, and the guy in the blind would have stuck around with any pair or any two overcards, and given the board texture, that meant pretty much anything. And there was like $60 in the pot, and I bet, and then the guy to my left raised with what turned out to be a flush draw and shut the third guy out of the pot, which is just really, really poor play, I think. Yeah, just because that guy's not going to fold a pair very often, and we're only $500 deep, so you're not costing yourself the chance to win a $3,000 pot from this guy. I mean, again, this gets back to just discipline and applying basic poker theory, but...
And having a plan. I mean, that's something that we've emphasized a lot, but not a plan for how you're going to play a particular hand, but an idea of where your money is going to come from at the table. Knowing that you don't just make money by playing cards in a vacuum. When you sit down at a table, there are particular people who are going to be the ones most likely to lose money at the table. And you're going to, in order to win money, you have to play pots with those people. So, you know, keeping them in the pot when you have a close decision, and you know, I think it certainly should be an important factor. It's not always dispositive, but I think it should be a big factor in your thinking. If it's close between calling or raising, you know, which one of those is most likely to keep the guy most likely to lose money in the pot? You know, knowing ahead of time that he's where your money is going to come from can help you make that decision.
Yeah, and I mean, again, it gets back to things like discipline and salience and perception and things like that. So put yourself in the buttons spot there. So the guy to your right, me, raises, you call, then the guy, then a very loose player who won't fold much of anything calls out of the blind, and the flop comes seven of clubs, four of clubs, deuce of spades. And it goes check and bet, and it's to you. So you see 7-4-2, and so you think about pairs of sevens and pairs of fours and pairs of deuces, and you think about flush draws, right, because you have a flush draw. I mean, those things are all right in front of you, so to speak. It takes a bit more discipline, especially if you're tired, if you've been playing for a long time, if you're clouded by the excitement of making a flush. It takes discipline to think about king of clubs, ten of spades. It takes discipline to think about jack nine offsuit that this guy might call with because he has two overcards and all these other kinds of hands. Have that discipline.
So keep the weak players in the pot. That's a big point.
Loose players are loose because they play more hands in more situations than everyone else. What are those hands? They'll be different for different players too. Some people like to draw to aces, even if they haven't paired their ace yet. Some people draw to any straight. Some people like to play these hands or that hands. I mean, loose is one of those categories that you need to refine. You need to be more accurate than that. I think there are some players who would be better if they never had the concept of looseness in their minds. You know, it's like, which hands is this person adding and why? What is it about this person's approach to the game? Which specific beliefs does this person have that causes them to play more hands? What are the loose hands? What kind of loose player? Loose with what and why?
Mm-hmm. And in what positions and what situations.
Yeah.
So position was a big point that I wanted to highlight, because in a loose game is when you're more likely to have multi-way pots, right? If everyone plays more hands, then you're more likely to get multiple people going to the flop. And as much as position always matters a lot in poker and especially in big bet games, it also especially matters a lot in multi-way pots. If you're out of position to three people, that's worse than being out of position to one person. And likewise, having position on three people is better than having position on one person. You just have that many more opportunities to get information from your opponents, or conversely, you know, that many more people are, you're acting in the dark with that many more people behind you. So you can really get away with playing a lot on your button in a loose game. You can come in cheaply. If it's one of these live games where you've got people, you've got like three or four people limping in front of you and it gets around to you on the button, I think there are quite a few hands that can be worth raising in that situation. But there are also some hands that I wouldn't consider good enough to raise that I would certainly limp behind on my button. And this would include maybe like weak offsuit aces, probably almost any two suited cards. I mean, maybe not real junk, but like an 8-4 suited or something, I would certainly limp behind if there were a bunch of limpers in front of me, and if we were reasonably deep. I mean, I wouldn't really want to do it with everyone only having fewer than 50 big blinds. But if people have, there are some people with 100, 150 big blinds, and no one is like super short, I think you can justify coming in with quite a lot on the button. Which might seem weird to people to say, well, it's a loose game. Like, why am I playing bad hands? Aren't I giving up the same advantage? I'm making the same mistake these people are by being loose. But you're making an intelligent decision about play of the hand. You're playing it in position, and presumably you're going to play it better post-flop than they are.
Yeah, that seems all correct to me. So we've talked a lot about sort of general principles and big concepts. Can I give a quick tip for loose games? It's just in multi-way pots, people's continuation betting changes its character. A lot of people will, even if they were the preflop raiser, they won't bet into four people or five people unless they really have something. So really look at continuation bets. Oftentimes, the way you would interpret them, I mean, oftentimes the initiative has very little to do with why they're betting. So you should interpret it almost the same way as you would interpret them betting without the initiative. That's not true for all people, but it's a common mistake I see. It's something I constantly remind myself. So if you're in a loose game, a lot of people to the flop, reevaluate c-bet. That's one place where I think a small correction to the way you think about the action can really help you interpret it.
Yeah, I can easily see folding top pair to a c-bet. If you got like under the gun raises, four people call, you call with like 10-9 suited on your button, and the flop is 10-4 deuce, and the preflop raise are continuation bets, and you're like a good size bet, 70% of the pot or something, everyone else folds, I'm going to throw that hand away.
Yeah, I mean, I folded top pair, top kicker in that spot. I mean, even without the under the gun raise, I mean, it's gone like limp, raise, I call, three calls, I flop top pair, top kicker, and it folds the preflop raiser who bets 3/4 of the pot. My standard play in a lot of live games is just to fold there. I mean, not against everyone, but I think you made your example, if anything, too weak. A lot of those, I mean, how would you interpret a bet without the initiative in that position? A lot of times it's very strong. Not all the time, as always, many caveats, but if I'm giving a quick tip, it's strengthen the ranges you assign to continuation bets in these multi-way pots, especially multi-way raised pots.
Yeah, and I think that's generalizable beyond continuation bets. I think just generally you're not going to see, like, people are going to play pretty straightforwardly in six-way pots, which is one of the advantages of having the button.
Yes.
Because the information that you're, not only are you getting more information, but it's more reliable information. If you know that all those people are telling the truth about their hands, then if it checks to you on the button, you can probably very profitably bet something like 20 or 25% of the pot and expect to win the pot 40 or 50% of the time, which is enough to show a profit. And then if someone bets, then you can know, I might be willing to call that preflop raiser's bet with like a flush draw, even though I wouldn't call it with top pair.
Sure.
And that might seem weird to some people, like, why are you calling with a draw but folding top pair? And the answer is that a draw has better equity against his range than the top pair does. And most importantly, has better implied odds. If I have top pair, there's really nothing I'm like hoping to hit. Even if I hit, maybe if I get real lucky, I'll hit two pair. But even hitting trips, I might end up just being, under trips with a better kicker or something. I'd like my hand if I hit trips, but for a best case scenario, it's not that great. Versus when you have a flush draw, you're drawing to a hand that's very likely to be best. And so the important thing is to recognize that you are drawing when a guy bets into six people, and then you can just ask yourself, what's the better drawing hand? Is it a draw or is it top pair? And as much as it might pain you to fold top pair, that's one of the advantages that that information is giving you.
And sometimes the perfect storm happens, and you can really do fun stuff. I can think of one hand vividly and several other hands that I have played where it's gone roughly like a five-handed pot, and the first three people check without much interest in the pot, and then the preflop raiser bets, and it seems pretty clear he's got an overpair or top pair, top kicker or something like that. And then what you can do if you have like bottom pair, but there's a flush draw on board, is call with bottom pair. I mean, it's a pretty big bet. It's often like $100 in a 2-5 game. So you're calling a $100 bet, so it looks like you must have something. And then everybody else folds the way you expect them to. And then, of course, you can hit trips or two pair, and then also represent the flush. I mean, it's not a complicated play in theory, but given the combination of the person's reliable information that he's giving to you by betting and the fact that people often check in a way that telegraphs the fold, you can make a call that looks really powerful, both because you're calling with people technically left to act, but not emotionally left to act behind you. And you're calling a somewhat larger number of dollars, say 20 big blinds or something like that. And so, you can sort of tattoo a flush draw on your phone forehead, even if you don't have it. And then plus you, you have some real outs against an overpair, top pair, or a hand like that. Again, it takes, there are a lot of ifs there. It takes a lot of things working right, but I don't know, maybe once every 30, 40 hours, it comes up and they can be extremely profitable plays when they do arise.
Yeah.
So that was my quick tip that only took 10 minutes.
I'm sure there's a ton more we could talk about with regard to playing in live games, but I think rather than us just kind of randomly trying to guess what might be interesting to people, you know, feel free to throw out some follow-up questions if you have specific questions about, well, I guess, about anything really, but, you know, just some ideas. If you have specific questions about other circumstances that might come up in loose games, please email us podcast@thinkingpoker.net, and you know, we can certainly do a future strategy segment that continues this discussion or that goes off on some tangent discussion.
Absolutely. So for now, there will be psychological challenges. Prepare yourself for them. Remember that position, it matters more and it matters differently. And continuation bets, all bets, especially continuation bets, they mean different things in a loose game. So keep those things in mind. We think your results will improve. And if you have questions, please podcast@thinkingpoker.net.
And if you're able to use any of that in a game, we'd love to see an example where, you know, where someone went in and said, oh, I'm going to try out this thing I just heard Nate and Andrew talking about. And whether it works for you or not, you know, if it doesn't work, then hopefully we can talk about what maybe would have made it work. And if it does work, we'd like to hear about that, too. We'll take credit for your success.
Vanessa Selbst. Vanessa has won two World Series bracelets, both NAPT Mohegan Sun stops in the history of that tour. She won Partouche in 2010, and she's had all sorts of other poker success, in tournaments and in cash games, live and online, not to mention as a coach and a maker of strategy videos. She's also a Yale Law graduate with a serious interest in social justice and civil rights. So thanks very much for taking time out from all that to come on the show, Vanessa. Where even are you right now?
Right now, I'm in Barstow, California, living in an IHOP, about to eat some bread.
Very nice.
I'm driving from LA to Vegas. I'm going to be in Vegas the next 2 weeks. I'm doing, there's a Festival Largo at WPT, and there's some pre-buttons, and then I'm also coaching one of the players at the main event final table. So he's getting there today as well, and then we're going to spend the next 2 weeks basically just doing a whole lot of coaching. He, you know, he's going to the final table with a chip lead, and I think he also just has a very aggressive style, and he knows that I also have kind of a similar style, and so he thought that, you know, I would be the best person to sort of give him advice, and, you know, I have a pretty good record in terms of, like, whenever I've gone to the final table with the chip lead, I've done pretty well, so, you know, I think he was excited by that to sort of, you know, talk about some of the things that worked and didn't work at the various final tables and stuff like that.
I imagine that would be a lot of fun teaching somebody like how specifically to beat eight people, not so much to become a better poker player in general, but like actually just to destroy certain specific people. How's that going?
Definitely. I mean, I've had some, you know, I've coached a lot of people, and this is really the most fun one so far, just because, I mean, first of all, how much is at stake is like ultimately really exciting. I mean, anytime you play any high stakes poker tournament in general, going into it is exciting. So now we're basically playing like a, you know, a tournament for like, I don't know, whatever the buy-in is, like $3 million or something. And, you know, so that's really cool. And then also, you know, just given how much information is available, there are so many ways that you can use that information. So it's just challenging in a whole new way. I mean, it's I've never done this before. When do you have the opportunity to do this? Where are you, like you said, you know exactly who's going to be there. You know, you have history with them, you've played with them before, you know, the chip counts going in and the seats. I mean, there's just so much you can think about and do. And so I think that also makes it really fun for sure.
So it's like the one drop, but even to another level.
Bigger, right?
Yeah.
And people actually have more than like 10% of themselves. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's some noise that they're going to do that again next year. Would you play, or do you have plans to do that?
The one drop, if it happens again and it's like as big a deal and as many people play, then I'll probably try to play. I mean, this year I was kind of on the fence, and I didn't, ultimately I was busy winning the 10 game bracelet, but it was actually at the same time. So I wouldn't have been able to play anyway. And I had a pretty good excuse. But yeah, I mean, I think I would play. It seemed really exciting, and there was obviously value there. So yeah. And in the past, I've sort of stayed away from the bigger buy-ins, but I've played a couple hundred K's now, and, you know, I'm feeling now that I'm playing more poker. I think when I was not playing as much, I shied away from those. You know, it wasn't that I wasn't necessarily confident, but it was more that even if I was a little bit rusty, I guess I would use that against myself in a way of like basically just getting too nervous about because of the buy-in. And so any lack of comfort of any specific spot, you know, I was worried that I would make a poor decision and it would be like such an expensive, bad decision. And now, you know, I'm just playing so much more. I'm really confident in my decisions in my game. So definitely looking to play some of those bigger buy-ins.
Excellent. So we wanted to talk to you about travel a bit, and you've been going all over Europe and everywhere to play poker.
Yeah.
How's the sort of poker nomad lifestyle treating you? Is this something you want to keep up? I mean, have you liked it?
No, it's awful. That's the thing is, like, you know, I'm 28 years old. Like, I'm not a kid anymore. I want to have a family. I want to have a life. Like, I have dogs. I have a girlfriend. You know, I have a lot of friends that don't play poker that I want to see and kind of have a community of people and, you know, be on a sports team or, like, I want to volunteer at organizations. I want to coach a little league sports team. You know, all these things that I want to do that, you know, without any kind of continuity living somewhere, it's just almost impossible to do. And, you know, I have a problem, which is that I really love deep stack, high stakes poker tournaments. And that's a really specific thing. Like, I mean, that's by far my best form of poker, the most profitable one, and the things I enjoy doing the most. And the problem is, you know, you have to travel if that's kind of your job. So, you know, I haven't really given that much thought to how to. And it's funny, I just went to World Series Europe and WPT Malta, WPT Paris, all those tournaments, Bartouche. And actually, I wound up leaving. I was supposed to go to San Remo, of course, the EPT, you know, and Poker Stars Pro, like, they want me to go to EPTs. But I was just so over the trip, you know. I was like, we just got a new puppy like 2 weeks before I left, basically, and you know, I just couldn't stand to be away any longer, and I just left, even though I was literally like, I was in Cannes, which is like less than 2 hours drive from San Remo, and I just left because I couldn't do it. And so I don't, you know, it's getting harder as I get older for sure. And I don't know the answer. Hopefully once online poker gets regulated in the States, we'll be able to play from home and, you know, I can travel less, I guess, is the solution. But, so, you know, I don't know. Things always come up.
You actually have a law background. I mean, do you see that happening soon, the regulation?
Oh, do I? I haven't really followed, honestly. It's, like, not the kind of law that I am interested in. And I, you know, it's interesting, but it's, like, not. I just haven't really been following what's going on. I mean, I guess Nevada is pushing forward some sort of regulation really soon, but that's obviously not going to be anywhere near a substitute for actual online poker.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we talk a little bit about that other side of your life? I mean, I know you completed your law degree, right? Did you end up doing poker pretty much full-time straight out of law school, or are you still doing anything law-related right now?
Yeah, I actually wound up doing poker full-time before I was done with law school. Like, you know, I kind of, when I won Mohegan Sun and then Poker Stars signed me that year, and that was right after my 2L year, so I was kind of doing poker and law at the same time, and yeah, like, I pretty much stopped with poker. I only graduated in January, so it's only been, you know, not even a year since I graduated. So I've stuck with poker since then, for the most part. But, you know, like I said, I don't see myself practicing anytime in the near future, you know, down the line. Like, I don't even make plans for next year, so I have no idea what's going to happen in 10 years. But I don't see myself in the next year or two really practicing full time, but I do want to start, like, working with, you know, an organization or something to do some legal work and use my law degree.
Was that a tough decision to make? I mean, I get the sense from reading your blog that you're pretty passionate about the legal issues that you were studying. Was it hard for you to say, I'm just going to set that aside and focus on poker for a while?
I think it's hard for me to set anything aside. Like, I kind of get bored of one thing. Like, if I play poker too much, then I get bored of it. And then if I do law too much, I get bored of it. You know, I really have a passion for both things. And so it's like, yeah, I mean, it's hard, but at the end of the day, I love poker. I just have so much fun playing. And so it's like, I'll play, you know, for now it's been, like I said, almost a year, really mostly just playing poker. And I'm missing doing legal work, you know. And then once I start doing that more, I'm missing poker. So it's sort of just like a back and forth kind of thing. And, you know, but luckily I have the freedom to just do what I want. And, you know, when I get bored of one thing, I just switch over to another thing. Or, you know, the trouble is, I think, like I said, that lack of continuity is, you know, especially if you're working, doing actual legal work on cases. I mean, you need to, you know, have continuity with your cases. So it's
yeah, you can't just run off to Europe.
Right, exactly. I can't actually, like, I wouldn't be able to have clients, you know, for instance, that needed me, unless I was working on the case with multiple people or something. So I don't really know yet how to make that work, but it's definitely one of my challenges for the future to figure that out.
What would you be doing in, I mean, when you talk about trying to, I don't know if you're talking about working or just volunteering with an organization, but what kind of organization would that be? What kind of legal work is it that you're interested in?
I don't know. I'm mostly interested in, I mean, I'm interested in all kinds of civil rights law, racial and economic justice, I would say, or racial justice and economic inequality are, but that's, they're such broad topics that you can really pick anything. I mean, I'm also interested in police misconduct law. I worked in a firm that did specifically police misconduct litigation. So really, those topics, like I said, are so broad. There's just so many organizations that work, you know, whether it's like a big organization like the ACLU, or NYCLU or something like that, or it's, you know, a small local, like, community organization. I have no idea. It really kind of depends. Like, you know, I just moved to L.A., or I just moved, I guess, I'm in Vegas a lot. Now I'm spending more time in L.A., and, you know, I don't know if we're going to stay there or, you know, go back to New York or maybe go to Canada, spend more time there, you know.
Yeah, not many opportunities to work on police brutality in L.A., huh?
Yeah, well, they're not wanting for opportunities, really,
right,
to work on that.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Do you see that kind of stuff, I mean, not police brutality specifically, but the issues relating to, I guess, the civil rights and racial equality, social justice, do you carry that kind of thinking over into the poker world? Do you think about problems like that, or do you see problems like that in the poker community?
I don't know if I, like, carry that. It's a difficult question to really think about, because what does that even mean? I mean, you know, people's attitudes could be different. I mean, the way people feel about inequality. I think there's inequality in poker in the respect that there's barriers to entry if you're not kind of well-to-do. Mm-hmm. You know, you're becoming a poker player is taking a risk, and gambling higher and higher stakes is really difficult. But, you know, it's a lot easier to gamble high stakes if you have a safety net at home, where even if you lose your whole bankroll, you kind of have that safety net. And if you don't have that safety net, then it's much more of a gamble. So it's kind of tougher, which I think is a large reason that we don't see kind of a racially diverse or economically diverse group of people that are playing the game. But, you know, I don't know. Other than that, I don't really know. It's not really, I don't see much crossing unless you do have some idea of.
I mean, one thing that I've always thought is, one thing I love about poker is that people at the table basically get along, and people from all parts of the world and all walks of life come together and play poker in relative harmony. But there's this flip side where, at the same time, the poker world, and especially the World Series of Poker, like, much more than your average card room, is a basically sexist and heteronormative place in a lot of ways. I mean, certainly that's something that I would like to see improved. Like, are there any ways that you can see us sort of, like, going forward in that respect?
Yeah, I mean,
like,
yeah, definitely. I mean, I completely agree with you. It's definitely completely sexist, misogynist. Like, you know, are there ways of improving it? Of course there are. I mean, from, you know, the Royal Flush Girls, like, really? Like, what is this idea that we need to have, like, scantily clad women parading around a poker tournament?
Multi-ethnic scantily clad women.
Yeah, there you go. Well, at least it's racially diverse. So it's just that doesn't make any sense. Like, that's just a poker, you know. And until you have images like that, I mean, that's just such an easy example. And it's like things like that. And while we still have that going on, how are we possibly going to move forward? You know, it's like the World Series. You know, they've done what they can, but they still slip up every now and again. There was like some issues this summer with the bathrooms, and in the main hallway they just like took away the women's bathrooms. Once that pointed this out and made a big deal of it, they were kind of like, oh, you know, we didn't really think about it, and they switched it back, to their credit. But it's stuff like that where it's just comments that people make.
I think it was day 1C last year. They had Holly Madison do the shuffle up and deal, and sort of Jack Effel drooled over her for a while. Then
yeah, definitely. I mean, you even have commentators sometimes talking about, you know, there'd be a woman at the final table and you talk about how pretty she is or whatever. I mean, it's like, why is that part of the conversation, you know? But it's just, it's the same. I mean, it's like, what do we expect the poker to be better than the rest of society? There's some things where you can make improvements with poker vis-a-vis, like, you know, not having those, like, sex symbols, like, iconic sex symbols, like the Royal Flush Girls. But then there's other things that are just, like, what, you don't want men to drool over women in poker? I mean, men drool over women everywhere. So I don't know how I guess I don't know how feasible it is to expect, like, just because someone is, like, an administrator or some sort of position of authority in a poker tournament, that they're not going to act like they would if they were in a position of authority in a major company or something like that. Maybe that's just a really pessimistic view.
I kind of wonder how important it is to fight those fights in poker specifically. I mean, because I think the point you're making is that there's these kind of problems in a lot of different spheres of probably not just American culture. So, I mean, for people who are concerned about that sort of thing, about reducing the amount of misogynism that's out there, or about trying to address gender and racial inequalities, is it worth investing efforts in the poker world when there are still inequalities in places that I would argue are probably more important, like in the workplace? I mean, I guess the poker is some people's workplace, but I guess I'm not that concerned about racial or gender equality in poker, right, compared to equality in many other places.
Yeah, that's kind of why I was like, that's sort of what I was trying to say. I guess I said it less articulately when I was kind of confused by the question of, it just doesn't seem like that big a problem when these are the problems that exist, you know, elsewhere, yeah, in the world.
It is troubling how much, and I think the way you said it was, it just didn't occur to them that it would be a problem, like with turning some of the women's bathrooms into men's bathrooms. And it does seem like so much, yeah, of this stuff, people don't even really like most people. I think I had the same reaction that you did to the Royal Flush Girls. It's sort of like, that's creepy, why is that necessary? But I feel like so many, right, people are just like, well, obviously there are going to be scantily clad women, like, yeah, that's what, of course,
right. Exactly. Well, with the bathroom thing, it was there were so many different problems with it. Which was that, you know, they were in it was the main hallway. So basically, they changed the main hallway bathroom, but there was a side hallway where there was still one men and one woman's bathroom. But it meant that on breaks, you know, no woman could, like, if they were in the Amazon room, you couldn't actually get to, when it wasn't a break, sorry, you couldn't, like, run to the bathroom. It would, like, you'd miss, like, three hands instead of missing one hand or something like that. On the breaks, it didn't actually matter because, like, you could just change the other ones, because the only time that there was a line up in the men's bathroom was during a break. And during a break, you have 15, 20 minutes, so it doesn't matter anymore because you have the time to walk there. So it just logically, it only makes sense to, like, change over, make sure there's at least one close bathroom for each, you know, gender. But in addition to that, I think the signaling effects of having the walkway, and you see there's just, like, two bathrooms, and it's, like, the main drag of the Rio, and you have two restrooms, and, you know, it's just, like, the one sign that normally has, like, a little, you know, whatever, stick figure with a dress now has, like, a man, like, slapped over it. And it's kind of, like, this symbolic thing of, like, this is a man's space.
Yeah.
Like, you're reclaiming it, you know, we're reminded of that. And it's just, like, yeah, I get it. There's more. I mean, the numbers, you know, are there, but just because it's numbers, I mean, if that existed, then why do we care about racial diversity or gender, you know, diversity at all in anything? Obviously, you know, it's not just a numbers game.
And presumably they're interested in changing those numbers, or they've made some efforts to draw more women into the game. So hopefully,
yeah,
they're hoping those numbers are going to change.
Yeah. And like I said, to their credit, I don't want to take anything away from them. They fixed it right away. I think it's interesting that it didn't even occur to them that this might be an issue, because I think that's a sad statement about kind of what people's conscious level of, like, thought about the issue is on a daily basis, which is probably not very high.
Yeah, I think we're not really dealing with a lot of malintentioned people as much as just people who aren't real reflective on the subject. You know, if you haven't spent as much time as you and I and Nate have in liberal institutions of higher learning, you're not as much trained to look for that kind of thing.
I mean, you don't think Jack Apple was a women's and gender studies major?
Probably not. Probably not.
What odds would you have to lay me? I have to take that. He was. 10,000 to 1 did.
I don't know. I would lay at least 5,000 to 1, I think. And I probably wouldn't take anything.
Yeah, I don't think I would
take
that. What? No, I wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think I would take that.
Yeah, I probably wouldn't take anything less than about, yeah, something much more than that. I don't know, 15, 20,000 to 1?
Yeah, 20 was the number, yeah, I was going to guess.
I might lay you 10,000 to 1 on a penny. I don't know. It's
just for the chance of winning your...
Yeah, free-rolling the main event. That would be a heck of a story, free-rolling the main event on a... Jack F. Old Women's and Gender Studies.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't have to be a dollar. All right, I'll take the bet. So I owe you a dollar. You owe me a dollar. But if Jack F. Old was a Women's and Gender Studies major, I have to buy you into the main event next year.
All right, book it.
All
right. About.
I'll pass along a question that I get asked a lot, and I don't really have a good answer to it, and I don't know that you will either. A lot of times people ask me, like, what is it that a Vanessa Stelps does that makes her more successful than an Andrew Brokus, like a much lower rung professional poker player? And I always kind of say, well, if I knew, I would probably be doing that thing. But someone like yourself, who seems to so consistently have success in tournaments, even more so than other people who are recognized as pretty talented poker players, are there things that you notice yourself doing that you don't see other good players doing?
Definitely.
Any chance of you listing some of them, or would that give away the give away the secrets?
That's my answer. You know, what am I gonna say? Yes, I 3-bet when the early position opener was 17 big blinds raises, and there's obviously things that I'm doing that I'm thinking about. I would say that I think a lot about metagame, a lot, like in terms of crafting my, like, every single thing that I do. I would say there's like a push and pull effect, I don't really know how to describe it. I guess like every single thing that I do, like if I make one play, I'm thinking about what do I have to do in the opposite situation, or what do I have to do in a similar situation with a different hand to make sure that I'm balanced. Like, I think about balance way too much, and it probably makes me make suboptimal plays sometimes, but it's not the same that I'm perfectly balanced, but I'm constantly thinking about how to be balanced, and then what spots I can appear balanced in without actually having to be balanced, and what's like the maximum amount of unbalance that I can get away with while still appearing to be balanced, and things like that. That's stuff that I'm constantly thinking of, which is, I think can apply to every single decision that you make, and ultimately makes me tougher to play against. And, it's funny, I've joked that at the end of the day, I said before that, I don't care if I go out on like a really huge bluff, as long as I give at least 3 or 4 players like really bad headaches during the course of the tournament, then I'm happy. I do think that also making non-standard plays, and being someone that's known as making non-standard plays, is good because I can sort of gauge how people react to me. Like, if I'm making the same play against like 4 or 5 different people, but it's a play that this person's never seen before or wouldn't expect, and so they have to react on the spot, they have to sort of react to their best ability very quickly, and something maybe they're not accustomed to, because when people see like standard lines, they can react how they normally do, and they can go back, rely on their own experiences, which is a lot easier. But when you're reacting to something for the first time, a lot of times it's difficult for people. And so when I'm making that play many different times against different people, I kind of get a general sense of how people in general tend to react when they're faced with this situation. And so I go into that situation with a much better knowledge base than they do, if that makes sense. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say that was a pretty good answer.
Yeah.
And now our listeners won't be angry that we didn't ask you anything poker related.
Yeah. The long answer, to make a long story short, basically I play tricky, and I play probably trickier than I should a lot of the time, but I think ultimately it helps me.
It used to be conventional wisdom, like say on 2+2, that nobody could have an ROI better than, I don't know, call it X. And for a while now you've had an ROI much better than that. So you're either...
Yeah, there's variance, obviously. There's like, an ROI, if my ROI were true, I think my ROI in live term, if someone calculated it, I think it's probably a little higher, it's probably like a little under 350% or something. But obviously there's variance, especially because I think a huge part of that, honestly, is that I've done extremely well at final tables, and part of that is luck, and part of that is I think people play shorthanded really poorly. And so much of your edge when you're a tournament player, can come, like, if you're, like, heads up, for instance, I've lost one heads up in a tournament before, and that was to, that was, like, a women's event where we were, like, kind of short stacked. But in every other major that I played, when I found a heads up, I've won. And obviously, once again, there's variance there, but it's also skill. And it's, the difference between first and second in these tournaments is just absolutely huge. So it's like, if I had gone second in every one of the tournaments instead of first, I would have won just a little more than half of the amount of money that I've won.
Do you resist deal making for that reason?
Yeah, I don't really make deals. I've made one deal. I made a deal at Mohegan the second time around because Dan Shack like really wanted to, and he gave me a tremendous deal. Like, he gave me a significant portion above expectation. And I was just like, I can't really turn this down, but But yeah, I don't make deals usually because I just think people play heads up pretty poorly. I can handle the variance. Plus, like, not even just people not playing heads up necessarily extremely well, but even if it's someone who I think might play heads up well, the pressure of that moment and the money will start to impact people and things like that. So I think probably too many people make deals. But I can understand. I mean, if you've never gotten that deep and, you know, you're looking at a 300K difference or 400K difference between first and second, I mean, it makes sense. But
yeah, I think you're one of few people who can afford to eat that kind of variance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm extremely lucky to be in a position that I can afford that variance for sure. But like people, like when they're backed or when they don't have a large piece of themselves, like there's, you know, people that'll be, you know, maybe only have 20% of themselves. So they're looking maybe at a, let's say, 200K difference, but to them, they're only looking at a 40K difference. Then in those situations, I see people make deals all the time when I'm like, I think that's a mistake.
When they could conceivably, you know, pay off their makeup and have a bankroll, like have a workable bankroll,
right,
when the upside
so
really means a
lot.
Shot. Yeah.
Yeah. Just take a shot. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. Good luck to your horse. Good luck coaching, and especially good luck playing.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks a lot, Vanessa.
Cool. Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me.
Take care. And to the Barstow, California IHOP, where she was talking to us. Also, congratulations to Vanessa, who, since the recording of this episode, has won a 5K Festa El Lago prelim at the Bellagio, and also $1 for me in the Jack Effel prop bet. Please keep the emails coming to podcast@thinkingpoker.net. Also, if you download our podcast through iTunes, please rate and review us there. Finally, thanks to Vaclav Havelka and everyone else in Please the Trees. Not many bands mention the Popol Vuh in their bio page, but Please the Trees does. They also mention Neil Young, a more apparent influence. Havelka had an alt-country solo act, and he got together with some members of a band from the Czech hardcore scene, and you've been listening to what resulted from that. Very cool music. If you like what you hear, head over to pleasethetrees.com and check them out. We'll leave you with a song called New Heart.
I want to hear your hair grow. I want to get close to you. Within the reach of your voice, but not on a record or on telephone. Ooh. Ooh. Just about time to get back to my life. Maybe it's just about time to get me a new heart. I guess I'll just sit down right here and wait for some. I'll wait for someone to die.